for showing up on a Tuesday night. I wanted to express my appreciation. Most of you actually managed to turn in that quiz by Sunday night. Others of you have turned it in since then. I think at last count there's only one more that I haven't seen. And we will spend, 20 minutes probably on Thursday night going over it, talking about what you did and what you didn't do, discussing some of it. And you'll hear this announcement twice because I want to make sure that I can capture at least some of you. On Saturday morning, this coming Saturday morning, from 10 o'clock till about 1 o'clock, there will be the 15th annual United States Supreme Court Review. This is something that our faculty has done for, this will be the 15th year. And it's a group of our faculty interested in the work of the Supreme Court and primarily constitutional law. And although you won't be taking constitutional law this year, you will be taking it next year. It'll come very soon. And I think you would find it interesting. If you absolutely cannot attend, then perhaps you'll watch for it on our website and law school website, and there will be a video archive of it on the website, but it's not the same as being there. So I do encourage you to come. The court did some interesting work, put interesting quotes this past year, and it's worthwhile listening. And they also do a little bit of a forecast of the major events, major cases coming up, and I expect there'll be at least some discussion of Justice Kagan and the impact that that may have on the work of the court. So in any event, this coming Saturday, and I'll say that again, undoubtedly, on Thursday nights, you'll hear it twice. Tonight, we are going to spend exactly one class in what some courses spend a lot of time on. And it's fascinating, and I'm sure you're all going to have very strong opinions about it, which you should feel free to voice. This has to do with a group of cases. And the word group flatters it too much because they have got a lot in common, but they are cases in which the courts have been extremely reluctant to apply contract law, although they seem to involve agreements between private persons, and they seem frequently to have either consideration to support the promises, or they have foreseeable, unbargained for, but foreseeable reliance to support the promises, and yet the courts have decided not to. And so it's a little bit of a cautionary note dropped in by the authors of the casebook into the subject of contract law, that we have been seeing all the wonderful things you can do by way of making promises enforceable using either consideration or foreseeable, though unbargained for, reliance. Now we're going to look at cases which it really doesn't matter whether or not there's consideration, although the court sometimes will use an asserted absence of consideration to justify the result. The case in which there does seem to be consideration, or in the alternative, unbargained for but foreseeable reliance, and yet the courts have decided we're not going to enforce it. And the starting point, not surprisingly, at least change in society, as society advances or retreats or whatever direction we're going in. So you get a case like Balfour versus Balfour, 1919, but this case could equally have found cases dating from 18 whatever or 17 whatever, which sound very much the same as Balfour versus Balfour does. That was the case I asked you to read from 163 to 164. And so what we have is the Judge Atkin in this case. This is an English case, of course. KB stands for King's Bench. And he says, it is quite common, and it is the natural and inevitable result of the relationship of husband and wife, that the two spouses should make arrangements between themselves. To my mind, those agreements, or many of them, do not result in contracts at all. and they do not result in contracts, even though there may be what, as between other parties, would constitute consideration for the agreement. Right, give them high marks for frankness. I won't say the same thing for the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts in a few minutes. The consideration, as we know, may consist either in some right, interest, profit, or benefit accruing to one party, some forbearance, detriment, loss of responsibility, given something, you know that language. That's a well-known definition. It constantly happens, I think, with such arrangements, maybe between husband and wife, or arrangements in which there are mutual promises, or in which there is consideration in form within the definition that I have mentioned. Nevertheless, they are not contracts. And they are not contracts because the parties did not intend that they should be attended by legal consequences. That always seems a little funny because obviously the way they get to court is one of them has sued the other one. And so somebody thinks there are legal consequences. But I guess he means when they're made. In respect of these promises, each house is domain into which the king's writ does not seek to run, and to which his officers do not seek to be admitted. Of course, we now know the king's writ runs everywhere, and the dean and the king's officers seek to be admitted everywhere, including in your email, telephone calls, etc. So the court says, oh yeah, it looks like there's consideration. There probably is. It probably meets that requirement. And it certainly has all the trappings of agreements that are enforceable, but it's not. And says, oh, it's not because the parties don't intend it to be. Well, as I say, maybe, although one of them is now suing the other for the issue contract. So at least now if one of them thinks that it's enforceable, and the other one, of course, thinks it's not. But that's true of every plaintiff and every defendant I've ever met. The question is, why not? So the husband and wife, here's a typical problem that the courts are worried about. Husband and wife make an agreement, and she says, look, I'll do the laundry, but you do the dishes. We have a deal. Yeah, that's a deal. Who would think there's no consideration? Of course there's consideration. A clear bargain for exchange. Neither one has a legal obligation, either to clean the house nor wash the dishes. Neither one. But they have made an agreement. Each one is undertaking a detriment, induced to do it by the detriment that the other party is undertaking, and therefore there is consideration. How shouldn't we enforce it?
Does her husband away?
She does. She cleans the house. He's a slothful person. He doesn't do the dishes. Not only is she offended, but she feels that a deal has been breached. A contract has been broken. Why shouldn't the court enforce it?
There's probably going to be disagreements every single day between every single marriage, right? There would be a million different lawsuits.
There is that problem. Well, maybe our marriages would survive better if we took them to court every time. Just think. I mean, the litigation costs alone would gradually make the people agree with each other more.
But how far do courts want to have a say in people's personal lives?
That's the problem, isn't it? How far should the courts want to have a look into people's personal life? But how would you feel? How would you feel if, I don't care whether this happens before marriage or after the marriage, I don't know that it matters, and the two people are both employed, and they get together, husband and wife, and they say, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take 75% of what each of us earns, and we're going to put it into a common joint account, which requires both our signatures in order to withdraw any money. The other 25% of what we make, we all hold individually, spend it as we wish, and we agree that there'll be no quarrel about who has the control over that money. One of them breaches the agreement. It instead of putting 75% in, they start putting 50% in. And then when the lawsuit arises, they only put 25% in, 75% for themselves. Notice, as to not be sexist, I didn't say which one did, but one of them. How about now? Can we enforce that? Is that different?
Was it in writing?
Yeah, well, first of all, there, we know, we've looked at a lot of agreements, and many of the agreements we've looked at have been oral. There's a limited class of agreements that have to be in writing. That gives me the opportunity, thank you, to say one of the things you need to start doing at some point or another is to start reading the essay at the back of this book on statute of frauds. We're not going to talk about statute of frauds during the fall term. We will shortly after the beginning of the spring term. And it's a long essay. It'll appear on the assignment sheet for the second semester, not for this semester, but just a heads up. And it is coming there, and when it does it, we're going to do it in about a class and a half, and you won't want to have to try and read that entire essay in what would be, in effect, class preparation for a class or two classes. It's too long for that. And also, it's wonderfully soporific, so if you have any trouble sleeping at all, pick it up. Read a few pages, and I guarantee you'll have a sound sleep. Anyway, but there is a limited group of cases that are required, contracts that are required to be in writing, or else they're not enforceable. But these do not fall within any of those classes. There is one that says contracts in consideration of marriage, but this is not regarded as a contract in consideration of marriage. So it would be binding orally. Now, as with all oral agreements, we can have problems, evidentiary problems, about proving it if one side wants to deny that was the agreement. But unfortunately, in the case that I just put to you, they make this agreement in front of their four best friends, each of whom is willing to swear in court that they heard this exchange, this agreement. Would this be, is it, I guess here's the question, I'll try to be quite concrete about it. Is it that we're concerned about aspects of marriage that are less quantifiable? Although I thought that washing the dishes and cleaning, doing the laundry was pretty quantifiable, pretty objectively ascertainable. Does it change if it's material stuff, like earnings? So that what we're worried about is the kind of agreement it is, rather than who it's between. How about if when the husband and wife marry, she says, look, you understand that I want to have a career. And he says, look, I fully understand that I want to support that. She said, but what if we have children? We both want children, yes? He says, well, what I'll do is if we have a child, for those first 5 years before the child enters kindergarten, I agree that I will be available. But it means I have to quit my job. I'll quit my job. I will be available to do the child rearing. I will be the parent and taking care of the child for that 5 year period. Fine? She has a baby. They have a baby together. And she says, okay, now's the moment. Go tell your boss that, you know, make other arrangements if you can, that you can do your work from home, that'd be great. But if you can't, you tell them, sorry, you're not going to be able to do this for the next 5 years. And he says, are you kidding? I'm not going to do that. I got this great job. She probably says, you're not making as much money as I do, but that's okay. No, it's a great job. I'm not going to quit. Is that enforceable? So there are these cases in which, you know, part of you says it should be enforceable because they made an agreement. They both planned their lives based on this. What is a contract other than an effort to plan your life? That's true if I'm the automobile manufacturer buying sheet steel, or whether I'm a person in a marriage trying to figure out how my wife and I are going to manage to have our careers and have children. Or whether we're trying to figure out, you know, who's got to have the responsibility for what activities that are necessary to maintain the household. These are all efforts that people make in order to plan their existence. That's what contracts are for. That's the beauty of contracts. It helps you plan. And we know sometimes contracts are breached, and sometimes, you know, and events occur which are unexpected, which make our agreements less effective than we'd hoped. But in, on the whole, it's a way in which we can be, bring more planning into our life than we otherwise have. Otherwise, the chaos of human existence. Not to get too melodramatic. But on the other hand, some part of us says, oh, but there is, do we really want the state coming in to the middle of our marriage? Haven't we got enough problems without that? I mean, somehow or another, we've got to work this out. We don't want the government intrusion. You don't have to be a Tea Partier to feel that a little too much government is still too much government. And when they cross the threshold, now you can take the extreme cases, the agreement between the husband and wife about how often they'll have sexual intercourse, and say, oh, blow the whistle. Right? We don't want the state involved in that little problem. But how about on the other extreme, agreements with respect to handling of the family's individually earned income? Now, we're not talking about something that's intimate. Well, I mean, I guess I feel pretty intimate with my money, but it's not intimate in the same sense as the husband's and wife's intimate physical relationship. Here's a court saying, look, it happens inside the home. But this is, we're talking about husband and wife, but that's not the only place we can go. So, you have a child that's more than 18, let's say 18 is the age of minority in this particular jurisdiction, and you make an agreement. You say, well, look, I'm tired of you not doing anything around this house. You're living here still. So we're going to make an agreement. You're going to pay me rent for your room, and we'll give you room and board. So 19-year-old, 20-year-old says, okay, I understand, that's fine, I'm working, I've agreed to pay the rent. A month goes by, no rent, 2 months go by, no rent, 3 months go by, no rent. Walk in the landlord-tenant court, I want an eviction notice. Should the eviction notice? The court say, oh, come on now, this is an agreement between a father and son. We don't want the court interfering with that intimate personal relationship. Or it's okay if we interfere when it's father and son, but not when it's husband and wife. I mean, where do we draw that line? How about the uncle or the cousin? Is it just because there's a familial relationship involved? You know, we're very sensitive about familial relationships, and that's partly why we don't enforce donative promises. But we don't have to worry about that. We're not talking about donative promises. We're imagining business-like exchanges between consenting adults about material matters. But courts say, well, we don't want to get ourselves involved in familial relationships. Now, maybe it's because who needs the burden? It's bad enough we have to have all these drug cases. Do we also now have to husband and wives fighting in court all the time? We have that when it comes time for divorce, but do we have to have it over every argument they have along the way? They come and talk to us when they no longer want to be married. Then we have to act judicially. So this is a problem. And trying to explain why it is that we don't enforce them, and probably you feel, as I do, that most of these probably should not be enforced, but maybe some of them should. I have some sympathy, frankly, for the idea of enforcing an agreement between husband and wife over monetary matters. The interesting thing is that if it's a prenuptial agreement, in most jurisdictions we do enforce it. It's a separate category. Well, it's true, they made the agreement before they were husband and wife, but they made it knowing that they were going to be husband and wife, and that's why they made the agreement. But some of them by statute, some of them by common law decision, the courts will enforce prenuptial agreement. Now, not about how often they'll have sexual intercourse. That they won't do. But they will enforce prenuptial agreements with respect to property and income, which is what they normally concern.
I have a question sort of a historical nature. in the past, like in the 1800s or before, like in England, was there some kind of church courts or something that could sort out issues like this?
There were. There were. And indeed, there are still religious courts. Depending upon what religion you belong to, there are still religious courts that do. And of course, we do some of that work in family court. And just a question of, you know, how serious, if, for example, the arguments between husband and wife are adversely affecting the raising of the child, that's a family court matter. Family court will take jurisdiction. Well staffed with social workers, psychologists, to try to help sort it out. But agreements, we don't enforce. We don't enforce agreements. And the religious courts don't usually exist for the purpose of enforcing agreements. They exist for the purpose of enforcing what they see as religious obligations, obligations imposed by the religion on husband and wife, for example. And so you have religious courts in some, depending upon your religion, in some religions we have those. The judgments are not enforceable in civil court. So the enforcing is a little different. Well, let's take a look at what the court does with a more contemporary problem. And these are problems that have existed. And every state has enormous numbers of cases now involving at least one of the two things that this case involved. This case happens to involve both. That is, it involves the relationship and termination relationship between a couple who at the time of this decision, obviously this is Massachusetts in 2004, at the time of this decision, they could not marry. The other, and there's a lot of litigation now all over many states, United States, about problems, legal problems being asserted by persons who are not married. But the reason that they're not married is that the laws prohibit marriage between them. The other aspect of this case, though, and it doesn't really make any difference whether they were or were not married, has to do with the legal status of the products of artificial insemination, particularly the products of artificial insemination when they're done in a lab. They range. The case that I did not ask you to read is a case which has to do with frozen fertilized eggs. The process of fertilization produce more fertilized eggs in the lab than they needed, that the couple needed to give birth to typically multiple births. So the husband and wife agree to take the other eggs that they fertilize, could be with her eggs and his sperm, could be with somebody else's eggs or somebody else's sperm, and they freeze them. And then, of course, what happens is they get divorced. And they have a fight about the ownership of the eggs. And a fight about whether or not the eggs can now be taken out of the deep freeze and implanted in the mother for the purpose of bearing additional children who are, of course, the biological child of the husband from whom she's now divorced. And that's what that case is about. This case is a little different. This case is about a child that is actually born, right? The product of the biological child of the mother, but not the biological child of her partner. And she and the partner separate. They're not married because they can't be married, but they separate. And now she's bringing an action for child support. But her argument, the basic argument that this court is concerned about, is the argument that says that it's child support that's owing by reason of a contractual undertaking made by the non-biological individual. Was the partner in the relationship, but has now left. her obligation to help support the child. Based upon what? What kind of contract was this? We have to jump ahead a little bit. I apologize for this. This is what they mean when they talk about the law being a seamless web. Though I always resent the reference to spiders in this case, but a seamless web, because it really involves a question about contract formation that has nothing to do for a moment with consideration, but has everything to do with what we mean by agreement. Was there an articulated promise to pay for child support in this case? Did the trial court, who was after all favorably disposed toward the plaintiff here against the defendant, did that judge find that there was an articulated promise?
Yes.
An express promise?
Yes.
Did this appellate court find that there was an express promise?
Yes,
they did. They did not.
But they didn't enforce it. I thought they did.
They didn't find an express promise.
Well, they said the implied.
But implied promise?
Yes.
It's not the same as an express promise, right? Because an express promise is something that somebody articulates. What's an implied promise?
It was made by the actions of one of the parties.
Exactly. It's something that the court looks at what the parties said and did, how they acted, and says that I find implicit in it a promise. Now, this is not unique to this case. When we're in the beginning of the spring term, in the middle of winter, we will look at other cases where the question is, did the parties reach agreement? And we're going to look at a class of cases called contracts by implied agreement. And that's what the court was applying here. We look at what they said, plus what they did, how they acted, what were their reasonable expectations. And they find that the reasonable expectations of both parties would be that there would be support, including but not only financial support, for the rearing of the child, coming from both parents, coming from both partners in the relationship. So that sounds then as though it should be enforceable, but the majority said it was not. It was sent by Judge Rainey, who used to teach here, adjunct, wonderful, wonderful guy. And he served on the Supreme Judicial Court. He started out in the housing court here in Springfield, and he was put on the appeals court, Mass Appeals Court, then he was appointed to the Supreme Judicial Court. And now he's retired, and he's teaching, but unfortunately not here. He's teaching at Suffolk, much to my annoyance. But he's a wonderful guy. Very interesting to say. We'll talk about it. But what did the majority say? And why?
Basically, it's not parenthood by contract is not the law in Massachusetts, and that the court was uncomfortable. Basically obligated someone to be
Why? How do we get to? I thought that they found that there was an implied promise of support. So the implied promise of support, that doesn't sound like parenting at all. I mean, right? I mean, we could have the father of the child who's not married, that father is going to be held liable for support, even though he's never had a marital relationship and he hasn't even usually promised.
But she wasn't considered a parent.
Does that matter?
Yeah.
Why? If she promised, forget their relationships. Suppose they were just good friends. And the good friend said, I know you want to have a baby, and I know you're concerned about your financial situation. I want you to know that if you do have the baby, I will support it financially. Okay. Now I've eliminated any concerns about the, any part of the homosexual relationship here. Forget that. She goes ahead and has the baby. As I've described it, would you say the promise is enforceable? And if so, why or how? Or if it's not enforceable, why?
Well, the way you described it, it would be enforceable because there was consideration in one part.
But what's the consideration?
Well, one of the parties received the benefit of having a child after the child was born, but failed to perform on his part of the bargain for supporting the child. So there was...
But if I look at this from the standpoint of consideration, at the time the promise is made, would there be any consideration as I've described it?
Well, because she relied on...
Is reliance consideration?
No.
No. Well, it can be if it's bargained for, but not otherwise. So you don't really want to answer me, oh, that's reliance. You could say that's bargained for reliance, but I don't know what we're going to use to demonstrate that this is something that the supportive person is bargaining for. It sounds like a gift, does it not? Like a promise of a gift? But we know the promise of gift can be enforced if there is...
reliance.
Yes, unbargained for reliance, which should reasonably be expected. So, if I have a transaction in which person A says to person B, look, you know, if you have a baby, I will help with the support if you need it. You would say, well, that's the promise of a donative character, but on the other hand, it's one which the person making the promise should reasonably expect under the circumstance would be relied upon. And if so, then it can be enforced based upon what wonderful principle? We call by a number or by a name? Section 90 is the number. The name would be promissory estoppel. Promissory estoppel. Okay. In this case, the court, once we have a promise, in order to find the promise enforceable, what do we have to look for? We have to look for either consideration, or we have to look for unbargained for but to be expected reliance. Because if we don't have those, we don't have an enforceable promise. So they found the promise implied, but nevertheless a promise. So the majority then did what courts have to do. They then ask, okay, but how do we support the promise? And what answer do they come up with?
So the child being born was the consideration of giving birth.
That's not what they came up with. A little hard to say the child being born is consideration. I mean, among other problems, it's not the event that occurs at the time the contract is made, and also the issue of who benefits from it. Well, are you a father?
No.
Okay, well, we'll have this discussion after you're a father.
Was
it
something about the agreement to create the child together?
But they did have that. The court finds that there was an agreement, don't they? They find it's implied. They say we don't find any express agreement, but we find an implied agreement. That's what's a little surprising about this decision. And I think that they got there because they had a problem, because that was the view of the trial court. And typically, a lot of weight is going to be given, because this is really a question of fact. It's a question of law. It's mixed fact and law. But it's very heavily factually oriented. What was the nature of the understanding between the parties is a question of fact. The appellate court is very reluctant to overturn it. So the court probably a little reluctantly finds that, okay, there's an implied promise. We pretty much have to go there because we've been told we have to go there by the trial court. And that's really all we know about this case. We have a record and we have a trial court who heard all the witnesses. But what the appellate court then says, what this court then says is, okay, but if we have the implied promise, for that implied promise to be enforceable, we have to find consideration. And where do they identify the consideration would be? This is what you need to look at in order to understand why the court did what they did, and also to understand the nature of the disagreement between the majority and the dissent.
Was the consideration that she's promising to support the child in consideration for being allowed to be the child's parent?
Yes. He said the consideration here is an agreement about parenthood. That's the consideration being offered, an acknowledgement by the birth mother of the rights of parenthood of the non-biologically related partner. And the court says, we can't enforce that kind of promise. We can't recognize that kind of consideration. I mean, that's not something that parties can agree to, that we can enforce. Having to do with, you know, parental relationships, no, we can't do that. Now, does Judge Grady, Justice Grady, does he disagree with that? Does he want to find that there is consideration supporting the promise, that we have an implied promise to pay support, and reciprocally it's met by consideration coming from the biological mother to the non-biological partner?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Because, you see, he says, look, parenthood is not the business of private agreement in any event. Who decides parenthood? Who decides who's the parent of an infant? The state decides it. The state decides that. That's up to the state. That's why we have all these custody laws and all that stuff. The state decides who has parental obligations. If they decided that this parent, this other, the partner had parental obligations under state law in Massachusetts, it doesn't matter whether they're ever married or not. It doesn't, nothing matters. It's the state decides, you're the parent, you got to pay. That's the way it goes.
I think I'm kind of confused about this case because the way I read it.
I know that's true, yes.
You know, I'm confused, it's obvious. They're saying that, okay, she can't be considered the parent, but the part to enforce the financial obligation is there.
The court said it's not there. The court decided exactly the opposite. This court, the majority of the court said no. There is an implied promise to pay financial support, yes.
Right.
Is the promise enforceable? No. Why is it not enforceable? It's just a promise to pay money. Oh, it's not enforceable because the asserted consideration is not a lawfully cognizable consideration because it involves a promise of parenthood, and a promise of parenthood is not the kind of promise that this court can enforce. And if the promise can't enforce it, it can't be consideration. If it can't be consideration, there's no consideration to enforce the implied promise of support. That's the logic of this case. Justice Grady disagrees, but I'm asking the question, on what basis does Justice Grady disagree?
Well, doesn't he say that most parents, they just have a child and that's the natural outcome, but in this case, they took all these purposeful steps in order to create the child.
So what? Yes, now he does recite those facts, they are important to him, but what's the legal theory that makes those facts relevant?
Well, that's the basis for the bargaining for the child.
If you use the word bargain, you're going to be bargaining up the wrong alley here, because the notion of bargain here just doesn't work, because the court, the majority has said, yeah, they were bargaining, but what they were bargaining for is not a lawfully enforceable promise. And Justice Grady does not disagree with that. Indeed, he says, look, it's not even a question of whether or not the court can, it's the kind of promise the court can enforce. It's not even the kind of question that the court, that the parties have a right to talk about. The parties cannot agree who the parent is. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit, if we get to it, about surrogacy agreements. I mean, you can get those agreements all you want about who the parents are going to be, but you know something? Nothing really happens until a court decides the custody issue, that the biological parent has to give up the child, and the court has to decide that the child will now be in the custody of this other individual, the acquiring couple. So he says the court is right that this is not the kind of thing we enforce. They're absolutely right about that, but you know something? It's not even the kind of thing that the parties can agree about anyway. That's not the point here. So what was the point? Why is this promise enforceable to Justice Green?
He talks about how deliberate it was that they had the child.
Yes, how deliberate it was, and
how they both, like,
just because, well, does deliberateness make a promise enforceable?
Well, they said that
we've read a lot of cases where people were acting deliberately and yet the court found it was not enforceable.
He said that that person wanted it so badly that she helped pay for it. She helped, like, bring her the appointments or something. She was a part of it every step of the way.
I need a legal theory. I'm waiting for a legal theory here because without a legal theory, I don't have anything.
He said the defendant's prior conduct stops her from denying a support allegation.
So what's the theory?
Promissory estoppel.
Yeah, the theory is promissory estoppel. Justice Graney is making use of your old friend Section 90. His argument is, look, once I find, I agree with the majority about the existence of an implied promise. Well, once I have that implied promise, I say, and what impact did that implied promise have on the plaintiff, on the biological mother? And the answer is, it encouraged her to go ahead and become a mother. That is detrimental reliance, if I ever saw any. He said, and we don't even speculate about was it foreseeable. Of course it was. It was a subject of their conversations. And so by doing that, he avoids entirely what was bothering the court. It was never bothering the court that you had a promise to pay money. Courts enforce promises to pay money all the time. That's principally what courts enforce, is promises to pay money. What troubled the majority, at least what they said troubled them, I think it's a little disingenuous, but what they say troubled them, was that the consideration was not valid consideration because it was not the kind of promise that the courts of Massachusetts will enforce, a promise having to do with parenthood. Who would be a parent? The dissent says, well, of course, we shouldn't even be talking about that because that's not something the parties can do. The parties can agree all they want. It has no impact whatsoever because who is a parent is a question of state law for the family court to decide. But he said, what we have here is a promise, an implied promise that was made that was definitely relied upon. The reliance was foreseeable. And under our legal system, we enforce promises when somebody foreseeably relies upon those promises. Therefore, it's enforceable based upon promissory estoppel. Anyway, why do I say disingenuous? What do I think is really at stake? Why did the majority refuse?
Because they're lesbians.
Yeah. Because they didn't want the courts to get involved in a fight between a lesbian couple. That's why. Sorry to say that, but that's why, I think. But you know, that's not very far from the Balfour versus Balfour, the court saying we don't want to get involved in marital disputes. The trouble is, of course, that the subject here was not really their relationship with each other. The subject was, and that's the point that Graney made, the subject is, who's going to pay support for the child? The irony about this, by the way, is a matter of public policy, because there's a lot of talk about public policy here. The fact of the matter is, from the standpoint of public policy, society is better off if a court order is issued against the non-parent partner. Because you know something? If the mother does not make enough of an income to support the child, guess who's going to pay? We are. Those of us who are Massachusetts taxpayers, we're going to pay. So this is not really even good public policy from the standpoint of the civic life written more generally. Now, in a way, only the tip of the iceberg. Let me tell you one that is a real problem now. And I'll move away from surrogacy. I'll come back to surrogacy for a second. It's an interesting topic, but very troublesome as a matter of law. Let's talk about organ transplant. That's a great subject. So my kidney is going south on me, right? And I'm in dialysis every day. And I can't last for very long. And I need a kidney transplant. And I'm pretty low down on the list. So I put the word out on the street that I'm looking for a donor. And somebody comes in, they have the right tissue match, and I say, $100,000 for that kidney. And they say, $100,000, okay, take the kidney, put it in me, I'm feeling pretty good. They say, where's the $100,000? And I'd say, I'm not paying you. We had an agreement. I've suffered a detriment. No question about it. You promised the money. There's a promise with consideration. Enforceable? No. Not enforceable. Not enforceable. On the other hand, just to show you how inconsistent we really are, I go to a blood bank and they say, we'll pay you $25 for your blood. I say, okay. They take some blood. I say, where's my $25? They say, come back tomorrow. Come back tomorrow. They say, come back tomorrow. I sue them. I can sue them. That's okay. Because why? Because the courts have said that's okay. So blood, I can buy and sell. Kidneys, I can't buy and sell. Now we have to have a, it's like, you know, we need a book about telling us, you know, which things you can buy and sell. And it's not always going to be the same. Presumably it's going to change. It used to be illegal to buy and sell blood. It used to be that you couldn't pay anybody for blood. And now we have a problem. Now we come back to servicing. So, husband and wife can't carry a child. Cannot carry a child. Physically unable to do that. So husband and wife finds a woman who is capable of having a child, and they say to the woman, if you have a child, we'll provide either nothing or we'll provide, let's say, sperm, do it by artificial insemination, it'll be your egg. It could be that we'll provide the egg and the sperm, we'll provide the fertilized egg, and you'll carry the fetus. All kinds of arrangements. They can do almost anything today in a lab, almost anything, except they can't grow the baby. Yeah. That still requires a mother. And they say, we will pay you $50,000 for it. Is that an enforceable agreement? Can it be forced against her? She doesn't want to give up the child. They've already paid the money. Can be enforced against them. She has the child, offers it to them, they don't want it, they don't pay the money. Is that an enforceable contract? The courts have said, well, no, but the legislature's come along, and in some states it remains an unenforceable contract. In other states, they say, oh, well, it's enforceable provided that the amount of money being offered does not exceed the actual costs to the mother who carries the baby. So it's okay to pay. You pay actual costs, and there's some fudge factors in there that includes salary she might otherwise have earned if she had to stop working while she was pregnant, and all that, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, somehow confined so that she's not making a profit. God forbid she should make a profit. Anyway, somehow or another, we have contracts that we won't enforce. And it's frequently kind of hard to figure out which ones we will enforce and which ones we won't, and why we're not enforcing them. This is the kind of decision that's probably better off made by the legislature rather than be made by the courts. It's not clear that the courts have any very much understanding or any great special expertise in this particular kind of question. But if the legislatures don't act, the courts have no choice. They have to act. Now, in the case of surrogacy, more and more legislatures are passing laws one way or the other, some moving in one direction, some moving in the other. And The rules of the game in the case of homosexual marriages with children get a little clearer to the extent that the jurisdiction recognized the marriage, as a few states do. And New York will be along very soon, I predict. Unless Palladino gets elected governor. It's an interesting group of cases, and all you can say about these is learn two things. Number one is that Justice Graney is clever, but also right, technically, that you shouldn't be blinded by the subject matter of the agreement. You've got to really look at the rules themselves, the majority wanted to look at that aspect of the case, which was clearly not properly within the contracting powers of the parties, but Justice Graney correctly said they never had to look at it. They didn't have to look at it. They had to look at it instead as a gratuitous promise that became enforceable by reason of foreseeable reliance. That's all. And neither the promise nor the reliance raise any issues of the kind that Balfour versus Balfour was concerned with, or what we started out with, about the intimate relationship of within the family. It's not the question at all.
So this whole case would have been completely different had she adopted. She never officially
That's
adopted
correct.
A child. So
That's correct.
Was,
it would have been entirely different. Yeah. See, if there had been an adoption, so that she was also a custodian of the child. It was her child. I don't care why she left or how far she went or the fact that they weren't married, none of that would matter. But what happened here was obviously that they split up before there was any opportunity for her to take custody. Now she did acknowledge that the child was in some way emotionally related to her. Remember, she took the picture of the child and sent it to friends saying, my son. Now, it was not her son because she didn't have any custody over the child. She clearly is a little too mixed up. She's a little out of her mind. So that's, you know, she suffers from depression. I mean, this was not a great partner, you know, but and she would not have been a great mother. But we don't want her to be the mother. We just want her to put up a little money. Well, that's right.
That's
it was
like,
had
my
no
like my child. You know, that person's child is like my child. It's not like a legal obligation.
That's correct. That's correct. And nothing about Graney's decision requires that you find any parental relationship. It does not. Because he said what we have is we have a promise. And that promise was relied upon. And that makes that promise enforceable. Now, the form of the reliance was having the baby. That's true. But we're not litigating about a promise to have the baby. We're not litigating about a promise to share custody with a non-biological partner. We're not talking about any of those untouchable questions. We're really only talking about was there significant detrimental reliance? And as to that, Graney said, of course there was. The facts are full of it.
But in response to Justice Graney, wasn't the original promise not to provide child support payments, but to basically parent the child?
That issue is no longer even controvertible, because not only did the trial court find that there was, I think they thought there was an express promise, but at least that there was an implied promise, and the majority says there was an implied promise, and so Graney doesn't have to carry that water. He said, oh yeah, there's an implied promise. I agree with the majority. They're absolutely right. There's an implied promise to support. Promise to support. It was implied, not expressed. Now, were they right in finding the implied promise to support? Well, we don't have to argue that. And indeed, I'd rather discuss it when we get to about January something or another when we talk about implied promises. And we'll see how hard those cases are. But normally what they ask is, would based upon what the parties have done and said, would a reasonable expectation of the parties be that the non-biological partner would be contributing support? And the majority answered that in the affirmative. as I say, resting upon affirmative findings by the trial court. So that's the end of the question from the point of view of, from Graney's point of view, that was the end of the question. He didn't have to worry about that. His concern was, and that the majority didn't concern themselves with that either. The majority could have said, oh, we don't think there's enough evidence to find an implied promise, but they'd have to kind of overturn factual findings of the trial court, which they were reluctant to do. And they thought they had this other neat way of doing it. And what Graney did is he cut the ground out from under them, which they sort of recognized in the last paragraph of the opinion, where they try to answer the dissent rather feebly, I thought. This is a lesson in bad judicial craftsmanship, by the way. It's clear that they wrote the whole opinion, and then he circulated his dissent. So they, what they did is they tried to add one paragraph to the end of their decision. It didn't work. What they had to do at that point was to rewrite that opinion. I don't know exactly what they would have said, but they had to rewrite the opinion. They at least had to provide, in their opinion, a really good answer to his challenge based upon the doctrine of promissory estoppel. He explains, by the way, that in Massachusetts, they don't really use the term promissory estoppel. It's not a jurisdiction which has ever exactly accepted Section 90. On the other hand, it really is. So they'll refer to it as estoppel. But if you look at all the facts and the way in which they're doing it, if you look in the footnote, by the way, it's a very helpful footnote from Judge Graney. If you have any doubt when I say when you reach Section 90, what you've got to do is you've got to go through every phrase in Section 90 and show how it applies to the facts, you can take a look at the footnote that he wrote and see exactly that process being undertaken by the court. That's at the bottom of page 180 in footnote 1. It's worth reading. It's worth reading through for you, because you'll see what a good solid legal argument is when you're trying to argue this question of promissory estoppel. He takes you through each of the tests. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Nice job and a good example of good legal argumentation. If you have a question of promissory estoppel or trying to use promissory estoppel in the full exam, you can emulate the way in which he does that argument, because that's exactly the right way of doing that argument. It's a terrific example of it. One of the things which you should increasingly now be looking for, now that you, I hope, are beginning to feel so you're not quite stuck in the mud in contract law, I hope you're not, is to look at opinions as you read them. If you find a decision that seems pretty persuasive, particularly if you didn't think you'd agree with it any the way it's coming out, try to go back and figure out what makes it persuasive. What makes an argument persuasive? Because your task as a lawyer is to figure out what is a persuasive argument in a particular circumstance. And so sensitivity to the art of persuasion is worth developing. And I know of no better way than reading these decisions, and I'll try to find out which ones are particularly well crafted, and say, well, why does it work? What makes it persuasive? And particularly what you're looking for is the intermingling of the articulation of doctrine, the articulation of rule, and the application of the rule to facts. And see how that's done in these opinions, because that's what you have to do. You have to articulate the rule that's going to be applied, then identify the facts to which it applies, and show why it applies in a particular way that you claim it applies. What the result is of the application of the doctrine to the facts. And in that process lies the art of persuasion. Questions? Well, I will come in on Thursday with I'll give you a statistical analysis.
Okay.
of how you did in part one, which was, of course, just the laws, truth, false, plus one, kind of fill in the blank. I can't really do that with respect to the second. What I am doing, and on Thursday, I will be able to give you that result, and I will be able to, you'll be able to see exactly, if you bring in with you a printed copy of what you've done, you'll be able to see exactly, I'll go through what's true and false, which one you should have said for which, and why. We'll talk about them, and we'll talk about the ones that are more controversial, that is the ones that are more doubtful, and the ones that are more certain. What I'm doing with the second one is I am actually doing an audio file describing what I think our strengths or more often weaknesses, because that's what I like to identify, on part two, right? And so each of you will eventually get an email with a small audio file, but I'm not going to guarantee they'll be ready by Thursday because that's a little too quick for me. But I hope certainly by next Monday, I hope that I'll be able to send you an email and about a minute and a half or 2 minute audio file telling you about my reaction to what you did in that second question. What you missed, what you got, what you did nicely, what you didn't do so well. The first one, we'll go over. I thought that let me say this. There's a serious problem about close reading. Close, really close reading. And that has nothing to do, really, in a way, with studying law. It has to do with the way in which you focus on the words that are used. So if you want to go back, for example, here's, I'll give you something to exercise before Thursday. Go back and look at your own answers. And look at your answers to question one and, I don't want to get the wrong one. I hadn't planned on talking about it tonight. One and four. One and four are, believe it or not, exactly the same question, worded differently. If you had different answers to one and four, you shouldn't have.
Well, one's right.
That is true. That reminds me, you said one's right. That reminds me of the story my father used to tell. My father was a federal court judge. And he said there was one day when they had a couple of arguments in the morning, a couple of arguments in the afternoon. And he noticed when he looked at the docket that there was one attorney who was actually going to argue one case in the morning and one case in the afternoon the same day, and that he was on opposite sides of the kind of legal argument that he was making. And so toward the end of the second argument, my father from the bench said to him, "Counselor, I'm a little concerned about, there seems to be some conflict between the arguments you're making now as to what the law is that applies here and the arguments you made this morning." And his answer to the court, to my father, was, "Judge, I can only say this. I would be sorely disappointed if I lost both cases." So yes, it's true that if you answered one for one and one for the other, then one of them must be right and the other one must be wrong. Yes, that's correct. And I did that purposefully because I think that I wanted to see, you know, whether or not there were some issues about how closely you were reading. So go back and reread those, and I think you'll see what I mean by that. But you know, interestingly enough, on some questions that I thought were more difficult, the class did extremely well. Where I was disappointed had to do more with the accuracy and care with which the questions were read, rather than that. So this is a good point to see that, because I'll tell you, when I grade exams, there's nothing more depressing than reading an exam, which I'm reading an exam of a student who writes this really good exam except for one problem. They're answering a question I didn't ask. You know, they misread either the question or they misread some of the facts. And when you misread facts, or obviously when you misread the question, you end up writing an essay that is not going to be of much, not going to be worth many points. And so it's very, very important to make the point early on to see and then go back and say to yourself, God, why didn't I see that? Or, you know, what was there about it that I wasn't paying attention to, that I read it too quickly and didn't think enough about it and didn't realize what it was really asking or didn't see that these two were really the same, things of that sort. But, you know, I thought that, you know, in general, I mean, if you want to look at the bottom line, I thought the class did pretty well, and my only disappointment had to do with the poor reading. It didn't show up so much in the second question, I think, but I'm not all the way through those yet. I've done my statistical analysis, the first question is done, but I'm still answers. They are, I must say, not as brief as I hoped they would be. I had thought that they would be like half a page is enough, and I got some that were, you know, a full page or so. And we'll talk a little bit about what that might be from the standpoint of exam taking. One of the reasons I asked you to do an outline is the real craft of doing a good answer on an essay examination in law school is to do an outline first. I don't mean this formal thing. It doesn't have the A's and B's and little I's and stuff like that. But it has to be something that maybe only you understand, but it has to be a description of the path that you're going to take your argument from where you're beginning and what the points are along the way and where is it where you're going to end. You have to know that before you begin writing. Because if you start writing without having carefully worked out what your analysis is and then made notes to yourself about it, you're going to have problems with time management, and what's going to happen to you is you're going to end up writing too much on some points and then never getting time to write the stuff that you never got to, or worse yet, you're going to forget the things you thought of when you read it and started to analyze it, but in the process of writing it, particularly if you're a nervous writer, if you get anxious when you write, the process of writing it, you kind of forget things that you had worked out. And then you come and go to your exam and say, oh, I saw that. Didn't I put it down? You read, oh my God, I didn't put it down, but I know I thought of it. And does that happen? It happens. So how do you avoid that? If you have an outline done ahead of time, time management becomes very easy. Okay, I got 20 minutes to write. If I got 20 minutes to write, I better not spend more than 10 minutes on this part because I'm going to need 10 minutes on this part. And by God, you know, you get it written and you finish on time. So it's that's why I ask you to do an outline. I want you to get started with the thought of doing an outline. And when we do the practice exam, which we'll do in a few weeks, doing a practice exam question, I'm going to ask you to turn in to me both an outline and your essay answer, which is nasty of me, but only because I want to force you in doing the outline, because I know that the outline will become critical to you when you're actually sitting there in the examination, taking the examination. It's a great skill. I don't mean just for contracts. I mean for every essay course, that's the skill that you need. So if you're used to doing that in college, it will come easily to you. But if you're not, then you need to practice it. And a good way to practice it is to make use of those exams that are on the web. You can look through them now. There are numbers of questions which are largely focused on consideration, easy to identify from reading the facts. Any time now, take one, read through it, try to think through it, outline it, don't worry about the clock, don't worry about the time, just get the analytic process going where you think things, make some notes about what the answer would be, and then later on, you can practice writing out the answers. So, good habits to get into. Thanks all.